Part 1. Heir of Death. Chapter 1. May 22, 2007. The Aleutian Islands, Alaska. The winds swirled lightly about the faded yellow tin hut perched on a small bluff overlooking the sea. A few light snowflakes danced about the eaves of the structure before falling to the ground and melting amidst the grass and tundra. Despite the nearby hum of a diesel generator, a woolly Siberian husky lay on a sun-exposed patch of loose gravel, enjoying a deep sleep. A white-feathered Arctic tern swooped by for a look, then stopped momentarily on the small building's roof. After curiously examining the odd assortment of antennae, beacons, and satellite dishes adorning the rooftop, the small bird seized a gust of wind and flew away in search of more edible offerings. The Coast Guard weather station on Unaska Island was as tranquil as it was remote. Situated midway along the Aleutian chain of islands, Unaska was one of dozens of volcanic uprisings that curved off the Alaskan mainland like an arched tentacle. Barely 17 miles across, the island was distinguished by two dormant volcano peaks at either end, which were separated by rolling grass hills. Absent a single tree or high shrub, the green island rose like an emerald from the surrounding frigid ocean waters in the late spring. Lying central to the North Pacific currents, Unaska was an ideal location for tracking sea and atmospheric conditions that would brew into full-fledged weather fronts as they moved eastward towards North America. In addition to collecting weather data, the Coast Guard station also served as a warning and rescue relay station for troubled fishermen working the surrounding marine-rich waters. The site could hardly be considered a paradise for the two men assigned to man the station. The nearest village was 90 miles away across open water, while their home base in Anchorage was more than 1,000 miles distant. The isolated inhabitants were on their own for a three-week stint until the next pair of volunteers was airlifted in. 5 months out of the year, brutal winter weather conditions forced closure of the station except for minimal remote operations. But from May to November, the two-man crew was on call around the clock. Despite the seclusion, meteorologist Ed Stimson and technician Mike Barnes considered it a plum assignment. Stimson enjoyed being in the field to practice his science, while Barnes relished the time off he would accrue after working a station shift, which he would spend prospecting in the Alaskan backcountry. "I'm telling you, Ed, you're going to have to find a new partner after our next R&R. I found a fissure of quartz in the Chugach Mountains that would knock your socks off. I know there's got to be a thick, juicy gold vein lying right beneath it." "Sure, just like that strike he made wild claims about on the McKinley River," Stimson chided. Barnes had a naive sense of optimism that always amused the elder meteorologist. "Just wait till you see me driving around Anchorage in my new Hummer. Then you'll believe," replied Barnes, somewhat indignantly. "Fair enough," Stimson replied. "In the meantime, can you check the anemometer mounting? The wind readings have stopped recording again." "Just don't file a claim on my gold field while I'm up on the roof," Barnes stated jokingly while pulling on a heavy coat. "Not to worry, my friend. Not to worry." 2 miles to the east, Sarah Mattson cursed leaving her gloves back in the tent. Although the temperature was almost 50, an offshore breeze made it feel much cooler. Her hands were wet from crawling over some sea-washed boulders, and the sensitivity was evaporating from her fingertips. Climbing across a gully, she tried to forget about her icy hands and concentrate on moving closer to her quarry. Stepping quietly along a boulder-strewn path, she eased herself slowly to a prime vantage point beside a shallow rock outcropping. Barely 30 feet away lay a noisy colony of stellar sea lions basking at the water's edge. A dozen or so of the fat, whiskered mammals sat huddled together like tourists jammed on the beach at Rio, while another four or five could be seen swimming in the surf. Two young males barked loudly back and forth at each other, vying for the attention of a nearby female, who showed not the slightest sign of interest in either mammal. Several pups slept blissfully oblivious to the rancor, cuddled up close to their mother's belly. Pulling a small notepad from her jacket pocket, Sarah began jotting down particulars about each animal, estimating their age, sex, and apparent health condition. As accurately as she could, she carefully observed each sea lion for signs of muscle spasms, eye or nasal secretions, or excessive sneezing. After nearly an hour of observation, she replaced the notepad in her pocket, hoping that she would later be able to read the scribbled handwriting created by her frozen fingers. Slowly retracing her steps, Sarah edged away from the colony and made her way back across the gully. She found that her original footsteps had left indentations in the short grass, and she easily followed her imprints leading inland and over a gradual rise. The cool sea breeze felt refreshing to her lungs as she hiked, while the sparse beauty of the island made her feel energized and full of life. Belying her slender frame and delicate features, the flaxen-haired woman of 30 actually relished working outdoors. Growing up in rural Wyoming, Sarah had spent all her summer days hiking and horseback riding in the Teton Mountains with a pair of rambunctious brothers. A love of outdoor wildlife led her to study veterinary medicine at neighboring Colorado State University. After a number of research positions on the East Coast, she followed a favorite professor to the Federal Centers for Disease Control with a promise that she wouldn't be stuck in a lab every day. In the role of field epidemiologist for the CDC, she was able to combine her passion for wildlife and the outdoors by helping track the spread of communicable diseases among animals that posed a health threat to humans. Finding herself in the Aleutian Islands was just the sort of outdoor adventure she craved, although the reason behind it tugged at her animal-loving heart. A mysterious number of sea lion deaths had been reported along the western Alaska Peninsula, although no known environmental catastrophe or human-induced culprit was suspected. Sarah and two associates had been sent from Seattle to diagnose the extent of the die-off and determine its range of disbursement. Starting with the outward Aleutian Island of Attu, the team had begun island-hopping eastward, searching for signs of the outbreak while working their way towards the Alaskan mainland. Every 3 days, a small seaplane would pick the team up, then ferry them to the next designated island with a fresh drop of supplies. The second day on Unaska had failed to reveal indications of the ailment in the local sea lion population, which added a small sense of relief to Sarah. Blessed with high cheekbones and soft hazel eyes, the pretty scientist quickly ambled the 2 miles back to camp, easily spotting the trio of bright red tents some distance away. A squat, bearded man wearing a flannel shirt and a worn Seattle Mariners baseball cap was rummaging through a large cooler when Sarah approached the campsite. "Sarah, there you are. Sandy and I were just making plans for lunch," Irv Fowler said with a smile. An easygoing man on the thin side of 50, Fowler looked and acted like a man 10 years his junior. The petite, red-headed woman crawled out of one of the nearby tents, clutching a pot and ladle. "Irv's always making plans for lunch," Sandy Johnson responded with a grin while rolling her eyes. "How did you two make out this morning?" Sarah inquired as she grabbed an empty camp stool and sat down. "Sandy's got the stats. We checked a large colony of stellars on the eastern beach, and they all looked fat and healthy. I found one cadaver, but by all appearances the fellow looked like he expired from old age. I took a tissue sample for lab analysis, just to be sure." While he spoke, Fowler pumped the primer on a propane gas camp stove, then lit the hissing gas escaping beneath the burner, the blue flame igniting with a poof. "That's consistent with what I observed as well. It appears that the affliction has not spread to the sea lions of charming Unaska," Sarah replied, her eyes sweeping the green landscape around them. "We can check the colony on the west coast of the island this afternoon, since our pilot won't be back to pick us up until morning." "That will be a bit of a hike. But we can stop for a chat at the Coast Guard station, which I recall our pilot saying was manned this time of year." "In the meantime," Fowler announced, placing the large pot on the portable stove, "it's time for the specialty of the house." "Not that fire-belching," Sandy tried to declare before being cut off. "Yes, indeed. Cajun chili du jour," Fowler grinned while scraping the lumpy brown contents of a large tin can into the heated pot. "As they say in Nolens," Sarah said with a laugh, "laissez le bon temps rouler." Ed Stimson peered intently at a weather radar monitor, watching a slight buildup of white electronic clouds fuzz up the upper portion of the green screen. It was a moderate storm front, some 200 miles to the southwest, that Stimson accurately predicted would douse their island with several days of soggy weather. His concentration was interrupted by a rapping sound overhead. Barnes was still up on the tin roof, fooling with the anemometer. Static-filled chatter suddenly blared through the hut from a radio set mounted on a corner wall. Nearby fishing boats, their captains yakking about the weather, constituted most of the garbled radio traffic received on the island. Stimson did his best to tune out the meaningless chatter and at first failed to detect the odd whooshing sound. It was a low resonance emanating from outside. Then the radio fell silent for a moment, and he could clearly hear a rushing sound in the distance, something similar to a jet aircraft. For several long seconds, the odd noise continued, seeming to diminish slightly in intensity before ending altogether in a loud crack. Thinking it might be thunder, Stimson adjusted the scale view on his weather radar to a 20-mile range. The monitor showed only a light scattering of clouds in the immediate vicinity, with nothing resembling thunderheads. Must be the Air Force up to some tricks, he figured, recalling the heavy air traffic in the Alaskan skies during the days of the Cold War. His thoughts were broken by a crying wail outside the door from the pet husky named Max. What is it, Max? Stimson called out while opening the door to the hut. The Siberian husky let out a death-shrieking howl as it turned, shaking, towards his master in the doorway. Stimson was shocked to see the dog's eyes glazed in a vacant stare while thick white foam oozed from his mouth. The dog stood teetering back and forth for a moment, then keeled over on its side, hitting the ground with a thud.
Jesus!
Mike, get down here quick! Stimson yelled to his partner. Barnes was already climbing down the ladder from the roof, but was having a hard time catching the rungs with his feet. Nearing the ground, he missed the last rung with his left foot altogether and lurched to the ground, staying semi-erect only by a hearty hand grasp on the ladder's rail. Mike, the dog just... Are you okay? Stimson asked, realizing something was not right. Running to his partner's side, he found Barnes in a state of labored breathing, and his eyes were nearly as glassy as Max's. Throwing his arm around the younger man's shoulder, Stimson half-carried, half-dragged Barnes into the shack and set him down in an armchair. Barnes bent over and retched violently, then sat upright, clinging to Stimson's arm for support. Gasping in a hoarse voice, he whispered, "There's something in the air." No sooner had the words left his mouth when his eyes rolled up into the back of his head, and he fell over, stone dead. Stimson stood up in a state of shock, then found that the room was spinning like a top before his eyes. A throbbing pain racked his head, while the grip of an iron vise suddenly began squeezing the air out of his lungs. Staggering to the radio, he tried to let out a brief cry for help, but was unsure whether his lips could move because of numbness to his face. A burst of heat flared internally, like an invisible fire was consuming his organs. Choking for air and losing all sense of vision, he staggered and fell hard to the floor, dead before he hit the ground. 4 miles east of the Coast Guard station, the three CDC scientists were just finishing their lunch when the invisible wave of death struck. Sarah was the first to detect something wrong when a pair of birds flying overhead suddenly stopped in mid-flight, as if they had struck an invisible wall and then fell to the ground, wriggling. Sandy fell victim first, clutching her stomach and doubling over in agony. "Come now, my chili wasn't that bad," Fowler joked before he too became light-headed and nauseous. Sarah stood and took a few steps towards the cooler to retrieve some bottled water when fire shot through her legs and her thigh muscles began to spasm.
"What's happening?"
Fowler gasped as he tried to comfort Sandy before staggering to the ground in distress. For Sarah, time seemed to slow as her senses became dulled. Sluggishly, she dropped to the ground as her muscles weakened and refused to obey the commands sent by her brain. Her lungs seemed to constrict upon themselves, making each breath a painful stab of agony. A thumping noise began to ring through her ears as she fell prone on her back and stared blurry-eyed at the gray sky above. She felt the blades of grass dance and rustle against her body, but she was frozen, unable to move. Gradually, a fog enveloped her mind, and a field of blackness began to encroach the edges of her vision. But a sudden intrusion jarred her senses momentarily. Into the sea of gray popped an apparition, a strange ghost with a tuft of black hair over a rubbery face that seemed to melt away like plastic. She felt the alien gaze upon her with frightening, giant, 3-inch-wide crystal eyes. But there appeared to be another set of eyes beyond the crystal lenses, gazing intently at her with a sense of grace and warmth. A pair of deep, opaline green eyes. Then everything turned to black.